So here we are at the Holiday Inn in Burlington, Vermont, watching the sleet come down. The lot's full of cars. We're about to go into a gun show, and I'm, as a northern liberal, raised in a household that didn't have any guns, I confess to being more than a little anxious about what we're going to find when we go inside. It's a kind of a big conference room, sort of place you might have a wedding reception or a bar mitzvah, but here there's long tables laid out, and instead of canapes or drinks, they're holding mostly rifles. Some of them are older, made of wood and metal, and some of them are really, I would say, terrifying-looking pieces of machined black steel. Tell me why your T-shirt says Art, even though your name is Bill.
It's an abbreviation for Article 16, Chapter 1 of the Vermont State Constitution.
Which says
it defines our rights to defend ourselves in the state, which is our right to bear arms.
What is it with you Americans and guns? I'm an American living in Britain, and I've heard that question a lot in the last few weeks. For all the things our countries share, a common language, deeply entwined history, the way you love our TV shows, our attitude to guns and to the people who own them is profoundly different.
I own an AK-47 partly because of the reason that it's just an amazingly elegant, simple design. They're beautiful, just like a Mustang or a Jaguar or whatever.
We all know the stereotypes of trigger-happy Americans, southern rednecks with gun racks on their pickup trucks, urban gangbangers getting tooled up for a night on the town, and of course the gun-toting desperados of 1,000 Hollywood Westerns. I grew up on Westerns, was born and raised mostly in the South, and spent 20 years living in New York City. I've never owned a gun. But my little brother did. He was a deer hunter with a Grateful Dead sticker on one side of his truck and an NRA sticker on the other. I'd always wanted to try to understand that. I also want to get beyond the stereotypes. So I'm heading to Vermont, where I spend part of each year, and where many of my friends and neighbors do own guns.
Is it down here or is it down there?
Oh, well, there. That would be left.
I'm going to visit my friend Mark Dunbar.
It says half a mile.
His farm is in Craftsbury, which, like a lot of rural places in America, isn't really near anywhere.
I don't know what Casamia is, but it's obviously some local landmark, so I'm looking to see something.
Vermont is the most rural state in the U.S., and one of the most liberal. We also have the most permissive gun laws in the country. Anyone over 16 can buy a gun and carry it here, openly or concealed. If that seems crazy to you, welcome to the club. But this isn't a program about laws or policy, as important as all that is. This is about why people feel the way they do, about the history of guns in America, the culture that grew up around them. Maybe then I can also understand why that culture is so resistant to change. Hi, Mark.
Hi, Don. How are you?
Good. Mark was the first person I thought of when I started working on this program. I don't actually know what he's going to say about guns, but I know that I trust him. My kids live with him and his wife in the summer, so I trust him with my kids.
I'm Mark Dunbar, and I have lived in Vermont all my life. And my family has been in Vermont since there was a Vermont, and in New England since there was a New England, and in North America since there was a North America.
My daughter was staying with you.
Right.
She'd had a fantastic time. I came to pick her up, and there was a shotgun on the stairs. Or not a shotgun, a rifle on the stairs.
Right.
And I thought, oh my goodness, Zoe never mentioned that there were all these guns here. Start with your introduction to guns growing up. Were they introduced to them?
Right. So as part of growing up on a farm, we were introduced to firearms early because they were considered a tool to us at the time. All of my family has hunted, both for recreation but also for subsistence. Being taught how to use a rifle or a shotgun was part of that, because it was, you know, the only way you could get rabbit or squirrel or deer or bear or
a way to put meat on the table. And the guns that you have in the house, are they for hunting?
Most of them, yes. Not all of them, no. I do have a couple of firearms for self-defense. We're farmers in the middle of nowhere, Craftsbury has never contracted with a police force. There is some distrust of police in rural communities up here. I don't know about in other places. And that leaves us with the state police out of Derby, who are at best, if there's somebody in the barracks, 45 to 50 minutes away. It is a concern of mine what happens to my firearms, and I do worry. I think more and more about taking extra precautions, and I have always displayed them because I do, in my own way, consider them works of art. But I've had to rethink that more.
I wasn't exactly surprised, because I know Mark's a thoughtful man, but I was struck by the way that the recent shootings seemed to have caused him to consider his views. I mean, we're talking about someone for whom having a gun around the house is second nature. And he's felt he needed to think again about what that second nature really means.
We're here at a gun show in South Burlington, one of the first in Vermont of the year, where we are legally selling firearms.
But not everyone responded to the shootings at the Sandy Hook Elementary School in the same way.
To the present day.
What do people who come to this show, what do they particularly like to buy?
It depends on an individual taste. Right now, the public is very concerned that there are going to be more restrictive regulations in place, and people are, frankly, buying things that they think might be challenged.
Do you have any of those kinds of guns here?
I have one. It's a semi-automatic, and it will accept magazines of various sizes.
What brand is it?
It is the dreaded Bushmaster. It's clear.
Okay, now you always do that when you hand a gun to someone.
Yes, I cleared it before, I just cleared it again.
And that's so I can see that there's nothing.
You can
in the
see chain. There, and if you can't see, you carefully keep your, and you never touch the trigger
unless
you have attained a target or something that you wish to shoot.
I have to say, it doesn't look like it would be much use in bird or deer hunting.
Has nothing to do with hunting. Firearms ownership has nothing to do with hunting. You're trying to confuse the issue, my good friend. You're a journalist.
But I'm wondering.
And remember that you people are allowed to enact your profession of journalism because people like me who served, okay?
Right.
You're looking at a man who put in various forms of uniform, 42 years, okay?
Thank you.
From private to brigadier general.
Wow.
Yeah. So the Second Amendment has nothing to do with hunting or shooting. It has everything to do with being able to defend oneself and to defend oneself against a tyrannical government.
The Second Amendment to the Constitution says, a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. It's become a key weapon in the armory of the National Rifle Association, the biggest, most vocal, and most right-wing gun rights organization in the U.S. But back in the 1960s, the faces talking up the Second Amendment looked very different.
America is based upon the right of people to organize for self-defense. This is in the Constitution of the United States.
Here's civil rights leader and black nationalist Malcolm X.
He brought the Constitution in with him. I don't know why. What is that? Now, what article is that? The Second Amendment to the Constitution.
In May 1967, 30 members of the Black Panthers marched right into the California State Capitol building, openly carrying loaded rifles, pistols, and shotguns.
Adam Winkler is professor of constitutional law at the University of California at Los Angeles, and the author of Gunfight, The Battle Over the Right to Bear Arms in America.
They were there to protest a proposed gun control law, a gun control law being promoted by conservatives in California, such as the governor at the time, Ronald Reagan.
Why do we have a Second Amendment?
Well, it's a political instrument. It was part of a series of guarantees that were offered at a time when people were considering the new Constitution, that the new federal government that this new Constitution established would have checks on its powers.
Craig Whitney is author of Living with Guns, A Liberal's Case for the Second Amendment.
It became apparent as the debates on ratification went on in the various states that they needed something more to reassure people that everything would be all right. The federal government couldn't just trample the powers of the states and establish tyranny.
But as the Founding Fathers established the right to bear arms, they also established regulations.
They barred large portions of the population from possessing guns, such as slaves and free blacks, but even white men who opposed the revolution. The founders also had severe militia laws, which required gun owners to appear at public gatherings with their guns in tow, and they would be inspected and even registered on public rolls.
Over the last 200 years, the amendment has been interpreted in different ways. 30 years ago, Warren Burger, who Richard Nixon appointed Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, said that anyone who saw an individual right to own a gun in the Second Amendment was conning you. And yet a couple of years ago, the current Supreme Court held that precisely such a right existed. So what's changed?
Politically, of course, the majority in the Supreme Court today is even more conservative than Warren Burger. And when he was the Chief Justice, the preoccupation with self-defense in the American middle class was not as intense as it is now.
Why do you think that is? Why do you think we are more worried about self-defense?
Violent crime spiked in the late 1960s, early 1970s, right through into the 1980s. Following a turbulent decade, the 1960s had a lot of social and racial tensions, race riots, assassinations. Those assassinations led eventually to the 1968 Gun Control Act, which is still parts of it in force today.
When I was a little boy in the 1960s, I desperately wanted a toy Winchester, like the one Chuck Connors had on The Rifleman on TV. But my parents were both New York Jewish liberals who wouldn't let a gun in the house. Even a toy gun. By the time we moved to Memphis, Tennessee, I'd long grown out of any interest in guns. The Vietnam War was still going on, and still on TV. The Cold War was still pretty frosty. I had hair down to my shoulders and used to go to demonstrations. But the Memphis City schools required boys to take ROTC, a kind of cadet's course. Dressing up in an Army uniform once a week and learning to shoot was really not my idea of a good time. But if I ever wanted to graduate high school, I had to do it. So every week I put on my uniform. I also became a pretty good shot, but I hated every minute of it. My little brother was a different story. Our folks left Memphis before he started high school. Then in college, a roommate invited him to come deer hunting. I think he liked the camaraderie, being out in the woods with his buddy. And as far as I know, he never actually shot a deer. But when he died, my sister-in-law asked me if I wanted any of Al's guns. I said I didn't. At the time, I was more than a little freaked out. It was a side of him I couldn't really understand. Maybe a historical perspective would help.
In Virginia in the 1620s, there were more firearms than adult men capable of using them. And that was probably true of a lot of these colonies when they started.
Kevin Sweeney researches the history of guns in colonial America.
They did fear conflicts, both with Native Americans, but you also have to remember the colonization was very competitive, so they felt threatened by the Spanish early on, later by the Dutch and the French. As some of the more immediate and, say, nearby threats from Native Americans declined as they were eliminated or pushed away, military service became more limited. So there was less pressure as you move through the 1700s to really have a reliable weapon for your militia service or even have one.
What about the picture that we have of somebody walking into the saloon with his gun on his hips in the Wild West in the 1800s?
If you were a drover, someone driving one of these herds for several weeks to places like, you know, Abilene and Dodge City, which became the setting for so many Westerns. If you went into Dodge City, you had to check your gun with a marshal, sort of like checking your coat. I mean, they didn't want, you know, teenagers and guys in their early 20s who had been on the road for several weeks and were getting drunk to run around with firearms. I mean, they weren't crazy. And, you know, there was maybe one to two killings in a place like Dodge City during a year in the 1870s and 1880s. I mean, they'd kill more people than that on one half-hour episode of Gunsmoke in the late 1950s. It's a fantasy, basically.
Guns in popular culture go a long way back. The first Western novels, James Fenimore Cooper's Leatherstocking Tales, written in the 1820s, feature a lone rifleman, Natty Bumpo, who earns the nickname Hawkeye due to his shooting prowess. Bumpo's rule, one shot, one kill, could easily have come from Jack Reacher, now being played by Tom Cruise in a cinema near you. The hero of over 30 best-selling novels, Reacher is a former military policeman who drifts around the U.S. with only a toothbrush for luggage. He's 6'5" tall, charming to women, handy with his fists, and even handier with a gun. His creator is writer Lee Child.
To Reacher, a gun is a tool. He doesn't love it, he doesn't fetishize it, he doesn't desire it. He uses it if he has to, and then puts it down and walks away from it.
I have no other way of knowing but through your books that a Glock takes 9mm ammunition.
Right.
Or that there's a kind of a revolver called a Sig Sauer. There's a lot of attention to detail. How do you draw the line between that and fetishization?
In a book like this, you have got to be at least a little bit accurate and plausible. And also from Reacher's point of view, he is interested in the technical aspect of it. I mean, in a sense, I compare it to my attitude towards photography. For instance, when my daughter was born, I bought a camera and I really totally got into amateur photography and I loved all that stuff, you know, lenses, is this camera better than that camera? But then you meet professional photographers. They don't care at all. As long as it works and does the job, they regard it purely as a working tool. And yet the working tool needs to be described accurately in terms of how it works. So I hope in a sense that I'm giving a technical description of the interesting salient points of the tool without fetishizing the object.
Back at the gun show, we met people for whom guns seem to be more than just tools.
One of the things that I'm curious about is I'm looking around and I'm seeing an enormous amount of firepower. But there's also things like antique glass, old powder, I guess, tins.
Yeah.
Gentleman behind me selling old watches. Is there some sensibility that brings the non-gun and the gun parts of this together?
Yeah, I think it does. I'm also a fan of antiques and car shows. And if you go to a car show, you'll see the same dynamic. You have those that are into the modern, the powerful, the innovative, as well as those that cherish the past as part of their history. My father wants me to buy him an M1 carbine, which is a gun that he used in Korea. And he doesn't even shoot. So I think that's it. It's an antique dynamic. It's a history dynamic. And it's just a love of the machine, the engineering. My hunting rifle is a 1901 Model 96 6.5-55 Swedish Mauser. The original action was built in 1901. I used it to hunt deer.
Right.
So these are engineering miracles.
It isn't widely known, but guns were actually central to the American version of the Industrial Revolution. Not far from here, in Windsor, Vermont, the Robinson Lawrence Company pioneered the use of machine tools and interchangeable parts for mass production of rifles.
This becomes a pattern for manufacturing in this country that is adapted from guns to sewing machines, typewriters, bicycles, then, of course, most famously, automobiles. Henry Ford's chief engineer, who helped set up his manufacturing process, had gotten his training in an armory.
Tools seem to be a man thing, but
girls like tools too.
My wife likes to do wood projects.
I like to get in there and find a project. We made some fantastic.
But guns aren't just boys' toys. Wendy Butler likes to hunt with a flintlock rifle, like those used in the American War of Independence. Her husband Randy builds them.
The main appeal for me is that this is something that our country was won with. To go out hunting with one of these, you've got to be fairly close, and you've got to be very accurate. You've got open sights.
For women, it's very empowering that they can go out and do, something that traditionally has been a male sport. A lot of us enjoy gardening and making clothes and or knitting a sweater. Anyone who's purchased yarn and knit a sweater knows it's much more reasonable to just buy an already made sweater. but we like the process. And so I think hunting is very much the same way. The satisfaction that I get out of being able to sit down to the dinner table and eat a meal that I've prepared, you know, whether it was the vegetables that I grew in my garden or the deer that I was able to shoot. Randy uses the word harvest. I have mixed feelings about using the word harvest because I think that sounds like you're growing a vegetable. I'm not going to pick on my husband about that. He
just did.
All right. Well, I'm sorry, honey. But yeah, it feels really actually really good to know that this animal lived a life that was a more full life. I'm actually not a member of the NRA. But I am concerned about my rights as a gun owner, and I actually feel somewhat compelled to join the NRA.
The last time I fired a gun was on November 5th, 1978. I still remember the date because I was a graduate student in England, and there was a kind of fair for Guy Fawkes Day. I was with a girl I really wanted to impress, and there was a shooting stall. So I said, "Come over here and I'll win you a dog." I don't know how impressed she was with this little stuffed toy, but a few years later, we got married.
We're at the top of a hill in a clearing of a hemlock forest. There's basically a tin roof shed with a couple of wooden watchtowers.
We're looking for Mr. Blair.
Despite my fears, nobody I've met here in Vermont has shouted or harangued me. They all seem like reasonable people, but I just can't share their interest. I wonder if that'll change when my finger's on the trigger once again.
I can tell you a little bit about what we do with new shooters here, if you like.
Yeah, that'd be great.
Would you like a cup of coffee? We initially take them through about a 30-minute introduction.
Great.
And we go through safety rules, different types of...
I picked it up and I slid the slide because I was hoping to keep it open, but it's now closed. Oops, and those people walking in front of me made me realize I was pointing it flat. I really should be pointing it in the air.
Okay, so go ahead and mount the gun. We're not going to put anything in it yet.
Okay.
You can see red over here. That means the safety's off.
Okay.
Tight into your shoulder.
Right.
Okay, face on it, nose over toes here. Get the body forward. There you go.
Good. Okay. Pull!
Yay! Good job!
I hit it?
Smoked it!
Whoa!
Woo! All right.
Let's do that again.
Okay.
I really enjoyed that, and I could see doing it again. And it also reminded me that my brother always used to ask me to go trap shooting with him. He used to shoot. And it made me sorry that I never went.
Yeah, my name is Tom Blair. I am the president of the North Country Sportsman's Club. I think a lot of people have the perception that anyone who pursues any kind of recreational activities with a firearm is some wild-eyed crazy, and that's certainly not the case. We have people from all walks of life that come here, and very nice people for the most part. So,
I'm sure Tom is right. But that just makes it more difficult to understand why our national conversation on guns always seems to turn into a shouting match. Philip Baruth has just been on the receiving end. An English professor at the University of Vermont, he's also a state senator, who recently introduced a bill to prohibit the sale of semi-automatic rifles and high-capacity magazines like those used in the Newtown shooting. He withdrew it the day before we met.
It became painfully clear very fast that there was not the support it would need to move even out of committee. We're speaking to a British audience. This goes back to the separation of our countries. Both sides tend to honestly glorify themselves in their own histories. So one of the things we like to focus on is the way in which individuals performed courageously in that particular war. People will reach back to that history as a way of saying, this is an unbroken tradition that extends to now, and that my use of a firearm to defend myself and my family is what makes me a Vermonter. So there's a piece of it that has to do with the actual Vermont identity for many, many people. And I heard from many of them in this debate. There were people who were thoughtful and historically minded And there were people who were, you know, more or less blunt and not all that civil in how they pursued the debate, but they all shared the idea that this was a common identity that was under attack from my bill. What it comes back to for me is the idea that any attempt to regulate weapons is now seen as an attack on the basic right of gun owners to own weapons.
I may not agree with a lot of what I've heard here in Vermont. I have come to appreciate why hunters and target shooters do what they do, and why it's been so easy to make them feel threatened. But I don't see why anyone needs to own an assault rifle, or why we let so many handguns into circulation. Still, I'm a bit closer to understanding what's at stake for both sides. The roots of America's fascination with guns go deep into our history, and for some of the people I met, owning guns is their way of connecting to that history. For others, it's a symbol of their identity, a badge of independence, a bulwark against the chaos of modern life. And our national argument over guns is also an expression of the age-old struggle between the country and the city, which helps explain why the politics are so toxic. Raw numbers may favor the city, but American politics has long tilted in favor of the country. I've learned that if talking about guns is a good way to bring out what the critic Edmund Wilson called the American jitters, that sense of helpless panic that swept the country during the 1930s, listening seems to calm things down. If you view this as a complicated problem, then surely it has lots of pieces, and I guess what I wonder is there must be a gun part of it. You could say, yes, we should do more to help people who are in mental pain. We should do more to protect society from people who are so deranged that they're dangerous.
Right.
But, you know, is there a gun piece of it as well?
Well, maybe there is. I guess for me personally, I would want to figure out some way to keep people from like that having firearms and having access to firearms while still being able, if I were the person who heard screams and shots from the local school, would be able to grab what I could and go and help the best I can.